Welcome to the ninth episode of UN House Scotland's podcast series, Connecting Women's Voices on Climate Justice. Justin,
And Katrina.
members of UN House Scotland's Climate and Gender team. In this episode, we explore the environmental and gendered impacts of the Israeli occupation of Palestine, issues that are even more urgent given the rapidly worsening crisis in Gaza and the West Bank. We're watching a genocide and an ecocide take place in Palestine as we speak. Israel is bombing Rafah, where 1.5 million forcibly displaced women, men, and children are taking shelter. It was supposed to be a safe zone, but it is clear that nowhere is safe in Gaza at this moment. To better understand the disproportionate impacts of war and occupation on women and the destruction of indigenous Palestinian land, we're in conversation today with Manal Sharir and Dr. Eirik Skandret.
Manal Sharir is a Palestinian climate activist and researcher currently studying for a PhD in sociology at Queen Margaret University in Edinburgh. Hi, Manal. Thank you so much
Hi,
for joining us. Can you share a few words and tell us more about yourself and your current project?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So, about my activism, I've been for years involved in popular resistance in the West Bank against Israeli illegal settlement expansion, and also in building international solidarity with Palestine, both in the global north and south. And as you just mentioned, I'm currently doing a PhD in sociology, and in my research, I'm exploring the role of Palestinian semi-nomadic women in Masafer Yatta in resisting Israeli settler colonial disposition through popular resistance and through everyday resistance, which in Palestine we call sumut or steadfastness, and how through their resistance they've been able to resist Israel's attempts to squeeze the communities there into ever smaller enclaves as part or as a form of ethnic cleansing under Israeli settler colonialism. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Manal. We're really glad to be sharing this space with you today. And we're also really glad to be sharing the space with Dr. Eirik Skandret, Chair of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign and a senior lecturer in sociology at Queen Margaret University in Edinburgh, researching environmental justice and international solidarity movements. Thank you for joining us, Eirik. Can you share a few words about your work and your activism?
Thank you, Katrina. Yes, I'm an academic and an activist, and I think the two things go together. My focus on sociology is very much a public sociology, so I think that the resources of the academic study and research needs to be put at the services of social movements for social justice. So I've been an activist for many years in environmentalism, trade unions, men's pro-feminist activism, and international solidarity. And in recent years, been very involved in Palestine solidarity from Scotland and the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. So it's both a subject for me to write about and to study, but also to be engaged as an activist. That's where I come from.
Thank you
Thank you.
so much, Eric. So let's start with a broad overview and the most fundamental question. So in what ways is Israel a settler colonial state? And can you tell us how this impacts upon people and also upon nature, water access, and the environmental justice in Palestine?
Yes. Well, sociologists look at colonialism in various forms. If you like, there's the classic imperial colonialism, where there is a normally a Western European state that takes political control over of a territory with the view of exploiting its natural resources and its labor force, and seeks to then bring that labor force into a discipline of the world capitalist economy. So then it also uses the elite of the indigenous population as consumers of goods produced in the if you like the home state. So that's one kind of colonialism, but settler colonialism is a different kind where a population essentially leaves or is expelled from normally Europe to set up a new society, a new state, or a new way of living in a territory which is colonized. So in that situation, the population, usually the European population, has very little interest in exploiting the labor of the indigenous population, but only wants the land, the resources, the water, the natural resources, and therefore seeks to expel or destroy the indigenous population. And we see settler colonial states in United States, Canada, Argentina, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa. So it's a widespread phenomenon, and Israel is perhaps the most recent example of a settler colonial state. It's an important distinction, I think, because it moves away from any sense that it's distinctively Jewish. It's happened to various different kinds of persecuted groups that have left Europe and then exploited the land and resources of colonized territories, and as a result attempted to expel or eliminate the indigenous population. So you'll see that, you know, because the main interest of the settler population is access to resources, land, water, natural resources, that is why it's an environmental justice issue in particular. And this is, of course, a human rights issue as well, because the expulsion of the population goes part and parcel with that project.
Manel, you've written that since 2007, the siege of Gaza has restricted Palestinian farmers' access to their agricultural land and has exacerbated the severe water crisis in the Strip. What is currently happening in Gaza with water contamination and the risk of disease?
Yeah, sure. So since October 7th, Israel has been imposing a complete siege on the Gaza Strip, including cutting the Strip from accessing water, fuel and electricity, and food as well. And this is a culmination of decades-old practices to prevent people in Gaza from accessing clean water. Even before the 7th of October, rights groups, the World Health Organizations, and experts and people in Gaza were complaining all the time that 97% of the water in Gaza is undrinkable. And people in Gaza, they always say that the water they drink is mixed with sewage. And this goes back in history long before Israel imposed a siege on the Gaza Strip in 2007. It's linked to Israeli water apartheid practices that started as early as the 1950s, like a few years after the creation of Israel. For instance, Mekrut, Israel's national water company, started in the early 1950s building Israel's water national water carrier, and that water carrier took the water from the Jordan River, which is a main source of water in the West Bank, and diverted it to Israeli settlements, newly built Israeli settlements in the Nakob desert. And after 1967, Israel extended its access more to the Jordan River and started preventing or imposing restrictions on Palestinian communities from accessing the water of the Jordan River. At the same time, after 1967, Israel started building what we Palestinians call water apartheid infrastructure. So basically, and the one who leads that is, again, Mekorot. Israel built its water infrastructure in a way that Palestinians don't benefit from it. And this has badly affected the Gaza Strip because historically, the Gaza Strip used to partly rely on water that flows the southern from the southern mountains of the West Bank. So water apartheid in the West Bank affected the flow of water to the Gaza Strip. And people were left with no option but to overpump like the main aquifer in Gaza, and the overpumping led to its contamination. This has been combined with repetitive Israeli attacks on Gaza, destroying water and sewage infrastructure and restricting the people's access to fuel. So this prevented many sewage treatment plants from operating properly and led to mixing sewage water with underground water in Gaza. So what is happening now again is a culmination of what has been or what Israel has been practicing for decades.
Thank you, Manal. And the example that you gave just now of Mekoro to the Israeli water company is an example of something that you've called eco-normalization in terms of their actions. And the fact that Israel, as you've said, uses its expertise in agribusiness, afforestation, water solutions, renewable energy technology as part of this process of greenwashing. So maybe you could tell us a bit more about these terms, greenwashing and eco-normalization, and how Israel uses that to kind of normalize and promote its occupation of Palestine.
Yeah, of course. So in a chapter that has been recently featured and published in a book titled Dismantling Green Colonialism, Energy and Climate Justice in the Arab Region, I touched on the concept of eco-normalization, as you just mentioned. And I linked the concept with a green or so-called environmentally friendly projects between Israel and Arab countries that have normalized relations with Israel as part of the Abraham Accords, which is a U.S. brokered normalization agreement between Israel, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, and the United Arab Emirates. And my argument is that these eco-normalization projects seek to greenwash Israeli apartheid and settler colonialism. And greenwashing is when businesses, companies, or even states like Israel use environmentalism or project a green image of itself or of themselves in order to deflect attention from other oppressive practices, be it against the environment and against people, like the case of Israel. And as I mentioned in the chapter, eco-normalization reinforces Israel's greenwashing narrative because since its creation, Israel has been investing a lot in this narrative, be it through its afforestation projects that have been led by the Jewish National Fund. And even before the creation of Israel, like the Zionist movement's slogan was, we want to make the desert bloom by creating Israel as a settler colony in Palestine. And what eco-normalization reinforces, it of course naturalizes Israeli apartheid. It makes Israel looks indispensable in front of other countries, but it also reinforces two elements of Israel's greenwashing narrative, that Israel is superior in terms of technology, expertise, and knowledge to other Arab countries in the region and the global South countries at large. So it's like, again, reproducing this superiority and inferiority dichotomy between the North and the South. And another aspect, and also, of course, portraying Israel as an environmental steward. Another thing that Israel as an environmental steward in fields related to water solutions, agribusiness, and also afforestation, that Israel is a benign country that is ready to help other nations in the region, like those who are backward, who are underdeveloped and in need for Israel's support to support them and help them. And this is part of Israel's attempt, again, to isolate Palestine, because when Israel offers its technology to these countries, They become more reliant on it and on its technology and solutions, especially in the field of water desalination and green or renewable energy. And this makes Palestine and the anti-colonial struggle of Palestinians as a minor issue for many countries. And also it finances, greenwashing finances Israeli apartheid companies that make profit and bring that money back to Israel to entrench Israeli apartheid and build the settlements as well.
In this part of our podcast, Zeynep Al-Shalalfe will be joining us for a focused discussion on Israel's hydrohegemony. Zeynep, can you share a few words to tell us a bit about yourself and your current projects?
Thank you for hosting me. I'm Palestinian from the West Bank, from Hebron. I studied water in the university in East Anglia, water security. And I have been working in this sector, water, environment, since 2010. I worked in with several international non-for-profit organizations, including Oxfam, Kvinna till Kvinna, which is a Swedish organization, Women of Jones, French organization. And I'm currently working on Gaza emergency response with a Swiss organization. And I always worked in projects that involved the West Bank and Gaza most of the time. I work in water and I'm very passionate about water. Personally, I identify with water because it's a superpower. And I believe in the uniqueness of every creation, but with water it's very obvious that water is unique and irreplaceable, so it's one of the astonishing elements for me.
Thank you for that, Zeynep. We'd like to start off by asking you about a statement that was in one of your reports. It said that the water resources available in the West Bank are very different from the water resources available in Gaza. Would you elaborate for us on the distribution of water resources in Palestine and how Israel as a hydro-hegemon exploits water resources for the sake of enforcing its settler colonial projects?
Yes. So the major water resources, which are transboundary, that's shared between Israel and Palestine, is the underground water, and that's the main source of water for Israel and Palestine. And we have two main underground seas, which is the mountain aquifer that's shared between the West Bank and Israel, and the coastal aquifer, which is across the coast, shared between Israel and Gaza. And we have the Jordan River, that's also fresh water. So that's main fresh water sources. Israel has, since after the 1967, immediately after the 1967 occupation, issued a series of military orders that put water under the authority of the military commander. And then they introduced a permit system based on in the military law. And that permit system forbids any kind of work related to water without a prior official permit from the Israeli authorities, whether it's related to water pumping, extraction, distribution, or harvest, like any act related to water development. So that's the case. So while Israel is annexing, de facto annexing a large area of the West Bank through the illegal settlements and military training zones and so on. They are de facto annexing all the water since 67. So for the West Bank, there's a growing settlement expansion. And there has been an annexation, and like an official annexation plan to at least for the Jordan Valley area. In Gaza, it's a different reality because Gaza is cut out from the world, actually, and from Israel-Palestine. And it's being treated as a city-state. So Gaza for many years now has been relying solely in the southern end of the coastal aquifer, and this water and this source is overbombed from the British Mandate era. So it's extremely overbombed. So there's a quality issue. So Gaza can't drink the tap water. They drink desalinated water. So if the tap water is 1.5 shekels per liter, the desalinated, beer, 1.5 shekels, yes, per liter, the desalinated is 50 shekels. So there's a massive difference. So yeah, the difference is that Gaza is cut out and is solely dependent on the southern end of the coastal aquifer that's underneath it, while the West Bank still can extract water from the mountain aquifer with regulation from the Israeli authorities. So to put it in numbers, the share of the individual in Israel is 338 meter cubic per person per year of freshwater withdrawals. In the West Bank, it's 36. In Gaza, it's 5. So in Gaza, it's 1% of Israel. And in the West Bank, it's 11%. And if we speak about equitable distribution under international law, it should be similar. The distribution should be with similar shares, but that's not the case.
So, in light of Israel's violations of Palestinians' rights to water, among the other plethora of violations, how has the UN reacted, and to what extent is it able to exert repression on Israel when it comes to water rights and other violations?
Like, if I would summarize it in one statement, the role of the UN has been disappointing. We feel that we are pushing the wall here, which is the occupation, and the wall is not staying where it is, it's coming towards us. So the situation is getting worse, and throughout my lifetime, I'm 35 years old, I see it only getting worse. The UN has written some good reports. There's a report for the UN called Gaza 2020. It was written before the year 2020, and it said that by 2020, Gaza will be an unlivable place, like a place that's unsuitable for human life. And then 2020 passed, and we are in 2024, where Gaza is being wiped out from the map. And the violence in the West Bank is severe. Well, we hear words of the United Nations. I think the issue is that the United Nations is its members, and some members are more equal than the others, have more voice or have veto. So it's doesn't give equal voice to everyone, and that has not been to the interest of the Palestinians. Well, the United Nations is a place to is like a memory, sort of, to document the violations and so on. And this has been its function for. But has this been put into effect? I mean, the International Court of Justice ruled that the apartheid wall that separates that Israel has built in early 2000, 2002, is illegal, but this has never been put into effect. Like a statement that I have heard by one of the big experts in international law, he said the United Nations can give you a weapon by its rules or statements, but then do you have the power to put this weapon into effect? We seem, when we look to power dynamics, we seem to be in a disadvantaged place right now. Still, yani, not to say that the UN is not important for some of the resolutions or statements that they have issued, or but if there's no power on the ground or no political will from the big actors globally to put this into effect, then it's ink on paper, I would say, because there's so many violations against international law. I mean, the whole situation has been too long, and never-ending occupation, while it should be a temporary. So, you know, like when this is the only reality that you know and that you have known for the whole of your life, it's a disappointing feeling, actually. It's like when I studied my master's, I once heard about a big environmental organization. They say about climate change and tracking animals, which is, or species, which is a threat of extinction, that we count them while the number is decreasing, while they're getting extinct. So that is probably a good description of the job of the UN.
Thank you so much, Zainab, for sharing your thoughts on that with us. So we would like to just ask you one last question.
Sure.
And it is about aspects of your research that touch upon the leadership and also the struggle of Palestinian women under Israeli military occupation. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
I have not actually written much about women, but I have tried to integrate women and integrate youth throughout my work. So I'm a co-founder of the Palestinian Women Water Practitioners Network, which is a network to focus on women water practitioners' role in Palestine. And I worked with women and youth to support community education and youth and women-led participatory action research, where people document what the community is doing related to water and agriculture, like the community practices, whether it's traditional or modern, and try to develop and build from there based on that. As a woman myself, and as I see women leadership, it's more inclusive. Women tend to include others in decision making. Women are more specific or more precise about what they can, more aware of their capacities, I'd say, than men are. I mean, sometimes I feel, you know, like women, they have different layers of discrimination against them, from the occupation, of course, from the regime, the legal system, the political system, the social system, the social norms, the patriarchal culture. So different layers of discrimination, and therefore the outreach is deeper when you give leadership to women. And like an important note is that actually we make change when we are very conscious and aware that we want to give women leadership and activate their roles. Because otherwise, even if women are in leadership, we might be maintaining the status quo if we're not aware consciously of bringing gender issues, because the status quo is not for our interest.
Thank you, Zainab, for your contributions. I think talking about Palestine and learning about Palestine is like a responsibility for all of us. So as a final thought, can you share with us some ideas on ways our listeners can take action for Palestine?
Yes, I want to share a statement from a colleague from Gaza. He also works in water, Ribhi. He said it's, and I feel it's strong because it's coming from a colleague from Gaza. He said it's our obligation to stay happy so that the human inside us doesn't get defeated. So this is the first recommended action, because this is a very long way to go. So we should remain happy so that the human inside us doesn't get defeated. I wish that people educate themselves, try to learn, try to read, to listen. I wish that people in their place, they can try to integrate Palestine, and not always in political contexts. In different contexts, really related to environment, to science, to crafts. I wish, and this is something that people can do. And then continuing to protest and march and boycott and put the pressure on the regimes that is supporting the ethnic cleansing in Gaza currently, and the occupation that has remained for that long. When I studied in the UK, that was the first time that I live in a different context, and it was a very shocking experience. It was very traumatizing. And I found that maybe the living your whole life under conflict, it changed your whole setup as a human. So we have different life matters. We plan for our life differently. We see life differently. We have different emotional structure. I found that so much fear came into the service there. I see that we are normalizing violence because we can't cope with it, of course. So we can't sit and cry. We have life has to keep going. So it's hard. So I hope. Well, I hope that this will not be the reality for the rest of my life, and or at least do not be the reality for my children. And I hope people, well, maybe it will be. We don't know for how long this will go, but I hope that people don't give up, and like even if they do small things, but. It's a particular matter that's super long, has been. I wish it will not continue to be so, but maybe. So stay optimistic and do what you can do, and believe in what you are doing. So don't be overwhelmed by how big is the matter, but try to do your little bit.
Thank you, Zainab, so much. We actually I'm speaking for me and for UN House as well, and Justine, of course, that we all like wish to see the day that I thought we witnessed Palestine free and to not see any injustice in the world. So thank you for your time, and it was very informative and interesting to learn about the water aspect of Israel's military occupation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As we're still talking about eco-normalization and Israel's greenwashing narrative, Irek, you've written that the Jewish National Fund has been a means of ethnic cleansing and environmental injustice throughout its history, while portraying itself as an agent of environmental protection. So can you tell us more about this and the actions that the Stop GNF campaign does?
Sure. Yes, the Jewish National Fund was established in 1901 by the World Zionist Organization for the purposes of colonization of Palestine, for obtaining the land and settling Jewish migrants onto that land. It had within its founding shareholders had to also be shareholders of the Palestine Colonization Society, and it had as part of its deeds that when the Jewish National Fund took over land, it would technically not own it, but it would be a custodian and trustee of the land for the Jewish people, so to speak. So essentially what that meant was that the land could never be sold to any non-Jewish person, could never be worked by any non-Jewish person, could never be lived on by non-Jewish person. So that basically was a means of ethnic cleansing, expelling all the indigenous Palestinian people from that land, whether they worked it, owned it, land, lived on it, whatever, and replacing it with settlers. And so that's what it was set up to do over 100 years ago. It is now a considerably more powerful organization, particularly since the State of Israel recognized the Jewish National Fund as a para-state organization, has important role in terms of controlling all land within the State of Israel, and increasingly land within the occupied West Bank. Now, what has that got to do with the environment? Well, because part of what the JNF has always done is develop land, which has also included planting trees. And it's sought to raise money from, particularly from Jewish communities all over the world, in order to plant trees in Israel, as Manal said, to make the desert bloom, as it were. And it, sooner or later, it kind of realized that this was quite a valuable propaganda tool for it. So throughout the world, the JNF branches were using environmental narratives to promote Zionism. And within Palestine, the JNF was using tree planting to expel Palestinians. So after the Nakba in 1948, when Palestinian villages were destroyed and populations expelled or in some cases massacred, the remaining villages were quite often turned over to the Jewish National Fund, who planted trees on it and made it into a park to conceal the damage of the crimes of the Zionist militias. And it's still going on today. There are JNF branches in the UK, in Scotland, in many different countries all over the world, which continues to do the same thing. It raises money, particularly from Jewish communities, but also whilst it's raising money, it promotes Zionist propaganda under the auspices of environmental improvements. It portrays itself as an environmental organization. Its website says that it is the environmental arm of the Jewish people. And it turns up at global environmental summits, supposedly representing environmental improvement, but actually it exists for the sole purpose of ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and controlling that land. There is an active international Stop the JNF campaign, which is exposing the JNF branches wherever they occur, and taking various kind of political actions to target them and try and prevent the Zionist propaganda exercises and the fundraising activities in different parts of the world.
Thanks a lot, Eric. Manel, we would now like to take a closer look at the role of Palestinian women. You have written that Palestinian women are primary rather than secondary actors in the anti-colonial struggle for sovereignty and self-determination. Can you tell us more about the link between ecofeminism and the environmental and climate justice in the Palestinian context?
Yeah, sure. So I mentioned that within the context of the role of Palestinian rural women in the village of Deir Balut in the north of the West Bank in being able to protect their land, which is located in Area C of the West Bank from Israeli confiscation, mainly by tending the land regularly. Despite the dramatic change that happened, or because, of course, mainly of the Israeli occupation, through using rain-fed agriculture, which is a traditional, it's a thousands year old, years old form or way of cultivation in Palestine, and also in harvesting water resources in an environmentally friendly way. And so these women in Deir Balut, they or Deir Balut as a village, it was affected by the Nakba, the expulsion of Palestinians in 1948 when Israel was created. And it was also influenced by the 1967 Israeli occupation and opening up the market to Palestinian, to cheap Palestinian wage laborers, mainly for men. And this dramatic change has compelled the communities there to adapt to that change. And women played a key role in that. So they became the main cultivators of their land, and they've been like employing different and creative ways in terms of the cropping system in order to also adapt to climatic changes, not only changes related to the Israeli occupation. And this also resonates with the role of women in other parts of the West Bank, like in Masatir Yatta, where I'm conducting my research. So women in Masatir Yatta have been confronting the Israeli army, Israeli settlers, on a daily basis for decades, in order to be able to maintain access to their grazing areas, because these communities are herding communities, and they need the land as a source of income for them. And women, again, many men are in these communities are cheap wage laborers. So women take on the responsibility of maintaining this connection with the land because of these material changes that force them to also change their roles. And an ecofeminist perspective to understand the role of women and the importance of their activities that they do to protect Palestinian existence on the land, but also Palestinian culture and lifestyle, is necessary because it allows us to understand the interlocking and overlapping nature of the oppression inflicted upon women by Israeli colonialism or settler colonialism, patriarchy, and the neoliberal capitalist system that is embedded in Israeli colonialism. And by understanding their role, we'll be able to give more attention and do more justice to them, and also would be able to get more access to the knowledge and the wisdom, and also the tools that they've accumulated and through their experiences and through their resistance, which is usually something neglected because mainly it's what is centered in terms of resistance to the Israeli occupation is mainly men's resistance, while women's stories are silenced. And we need this knowledge. We need this knowledge in order to inspire other women in other parts of Palestine to do resistance. But also, this knowledge is necessary to challenge Israel's greenwashing narrative. So it represents the kind of indigenous knowledge and an indigenous perspective in terms of what true environmental stewardship means. And this problematizes Israeli attempts to moralize and legitimize its existence, which is immoral as a settler colony, as an and as an apartheid regime.
Thank you, Manel, for your detailed answer. We don't usually hear about ecofeminism in Palestine, yet it's central to resistance process, as you point out. As we hear a lot in the news, women and children are the ones disproportionately impacted by the occupation and the ongoing genocide. According to the Ministry of Health in Gaza, as of the 2nd February, at least 27,131 Palestinians have been killed in the Gaza Strip since the 7th of October. That number is bound to be much higher. About 70% of those killed are reported to be women and children. Manel, why do you think is the targeting of children and women so strategic for Israel's goal of erasing the Palestinian nation, and especially given that women are biological reproducers of a nation?
Yeah, sure. So, well, Itamar Ben-Gvir, Israel's Minister of National Security, openly said or ordered the Israeli army to target women and children. And this shows that the mass killing of women and children in Gaza as part of the unfolding genocide is not something random. It is or part of a collateral damage. It is intentional, systematic, and it is very well calculated. And it goes back to the Nakba. Like, again, it's important to show the continuation of Israeli practices and policies, even like before the creation or as part of the creation of Israel, because in 1948, it's been reported that if the Zionist gangs were responsible for atrocities against women in terms of raping women, but some testimonies from survivors show that pregnant women were targeted and killed in a brutal way. And this is informed by the Zionist doctrine of elimination of the Palestinian native population, as I was mentioning at the beginning. This is a settler colonial project that seeks to replace the indigenous population with a settler one, and in all in order to do so, they need to either expel the population or exterminate them or eliminate them physically through killing them. And as you suggested in your question, women are the ones who give life, or like symbolically and actually, they are the ones who give life. And also in Palestinian culture, national symbolism, they are the life givers. And targeting them is targeting this source of life and what it stands for. And also, for Israelis, these women are the ones who raise Palestinian fighters, or those who are responsible for teaching teaching Palestinians to be violent. As former Israeli Justice Minister Eilat Shekhed once said, that Palestinian children are these small snakes that are being raised. So She likened children to snakes that are being raised by bigger snakes, which are their mothers. So this is how Israel sees Palestinian women. They are seen as a threat to the whole Zionist project of Israel, especially because Israel has failed to demographically outnumber Palestinians. As a matter of fact, like the fertility rate in Palestine is the highest among the countries of, or among the highest in countries in the Middle East. And there is this kind of demographic war, like a certain group, which is like Israeli settlers, want or try to outnumber Palestinians. And another thing is that the expulsion of Palestinians in 1948 and their resistance, their steadfastness, either by establishing the Palestine Liberation Organization and refusing to give up on their rights and continuing to steadfastly living, calling for their right to return, has shown that that even expelling Palestinians is not like is not an effective solution for Israel. A more effective one would be like physically eliminating Palestinian existence, mainly by targeting women, and women are the caregivers of children, and also when they target the caregivers of children and directly target children by killing them, they target the Palestinian future, because children represent the future of Palestine. They also stand as a symbol of hope for liberation, that we want to invest in them in order to continue the fight until Palestine is free. So every Palestinian child who's been killed in the Gaza Strip, in the West Bank, in the present or in the past, it has been an onslaught on the Palestinian future.
Thank you for sharing that, Manal. You know, thinking about those words, hope and liberation, and the next generation of Palestinians, you know, taking forward this sumud or steadfastness and persistence and staying on the land, maintaining identity and culture. It's so important that we think about ways in which we can also be part of that sumud and give momentum to the steadfastness, which is an inspiration globally. And, you know, we can see in this moment of such horrendousness and war crimes that global movements and solidarity is more important than ever. So we were keen to hear from you both. Perhaps, Eirik, you could start and tell us a bit about the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions movement and also the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign and what's currently happening in terms of actions that people in Scotland and around the world can get involved with.
Certainly, Katrina, and I think you're absolutely right to say that the international solidarity takes its inspiration from the Sumud and the resistance of the Palestinian people that has been going on since the Zionist settlements first started to arrive in Palestine. So we take our lead from the resistance, the Palestinian resistance. And you mentioned BDS, and in 2005, a wide range of Palestinian civil society organizations called on the international community to adopt and support a campaign for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, BDS. And the demands of that campaign were threefold. One, to end the occupation of all Palestinian land. Secondly, to end the apartheid regime of different treatment of Palestinians within the State of Israel, within the areas occupied in 1948. And thirdly, to honor the right of return of all the refugees who were displaced from 1948 onwards. So those are the demands, and those are not very demanding demands, actually. They're simply saying Israel should abide by international law. And because Israel is refusing to abide by international law, and the states of the world are colluding in Israel's breaches of international law, then the civil society in Palestine called on civil society throughout the world to force Israel to abide by international law by adopting this boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, which seeks to isolate Israel, treat Israel as a pariah state that it is, that has systematically been breaching international law, international humanitarian law, since 1948. Since its very existence, and its very existence is in itself a breach of international law, in that the right of return, if honoured, would completely destabilise the theocratic or the ethnocratic state of Israel that it seeks to create. Now, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, as it says, it's got three components: boycotts. Boycotting the state of Israel, any agent that is representing the state of Israel, any artists who are funded by the state of Israel, representatives of universities in Israel, representatives of embassies, diplomatic outreach of Israel. These should all be boycotted. So if there is any attempt by these such agents to appear in Scotland, there's always a protest, there's always a demonstration, an attempt to try and get that closed down. And in the Edinburgh International Festival, there have been several occasions, and the Fringe Festival, where artists have been sponsored by the Israeli state, really as a soft propaganda exercise, and that has led to protests, and in some cases we've managed to cancel the performances in the festival. So that's the nature of the boycott, and it's a very accessible thing. Ordinary people can just check in the supermarkets and refuse to buy fruits or vegetables that come from Israel, through to the kind of protests and refusal to participate in international conferences or whatever that involve the state of Israel. And also any companies that are benefiting from the apartheid state of Israel, which there are a number of Israeli companies. You can look at BDS Movement website. You can look at companies that are benefiting from Israel apartheid and Israel colonization. Both Israeli companies and also international companies. Our own Barclays Bank, for example, which funds a number of arms manufacturers, as well as investing in Israel itself, funds arms manufacturers that are providing military components for the Israeli military. Divestment is the next stage up, and there are a number of, for example, public pension funds which have the opportunity to divest from these companies that are profiting from the occupation. And the ultimate would be sanctions against Israel. And really, it's state operators that have the opportunity to sanction Israel and refuse to cooperate with the Israeli regime under its conditions of breaches of international law. So that's the BDS campaign. It's anybody can get involved with it at a very low level or at a very active level. Civil society can support it, and it's important that a number of civil society organizations have signed up to it. Trade unions, churches, religious organizations, arts organizations, multiple different civil society organizations. This is all part of the isolation of Israel and pointing out of Israel as a pariah state that's been in consistent breach of international law. You mentioned about Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign as well, which seeks to provide effective solidarity with the Palestinian people, and BDS, Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, is a big part of us, as well as Stop the JNF, actively involved in that. Since the escalation of Israeli violence, and as Manal says, it's not a new war since October 2023. It's an escalation of what has been going on for decades. Since then, there have been protests on the streets of the major cities of Scotland every Saturday, called by different organizations. Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign has been in the leadership of many of them. In the Edinburgh and Glasgow, there are Gaza Genocide Emergency Committees that have been formed, made up of a range of different organizations that have made sure that the center of every city in Scotland is made aware of the call for ceasefire in the first place, and the demand that public bodies prevent the funding of the arms trade with Israel, and calls out Israel as a pariah state which needs to be boycotted. Ceasefire is the immediate demand. A just settlement, the dismantling of the settler colonial project, is the way in which such genocides can be prevented in the future.
Thanks so much, Eirik. Again, we'll post links and make sure that everybody listening is aware of those campaigns and ways to get involved. Manal, I don't know if you want to add anything else around global solidarity movements or any of the initiatives that you're currently involved with.
Yeah, sure. I'd like to briefly talk about an initiative called Faza, and Faza in Arabic means reinforcement or aid. And it's a campaign that was created by Palestinian grassroots groups and youth activists in the West Bank in 2019. And the idea is to provide protection to Palestinian farmers during the olive harvest season by accompanying them. So both Palestinian activists and international solidarity activists who come from different parts of the world join the farmers during the harvest season, which starts usually in October, at the beginning of October until the beginning of November. And they document Israeli human rights violations committed by both settlers and the Israeli army. And the presence of international activists also makes settlers more hesitant to, or less violent than when there is only Palestinians harvesting their olive trees. And the Faza campaign is important in more than one aspect. I'd like to start talking about the economic aspect. So as a matter of fact, half of the cultivated land in both the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are cultivated with olive trees. And that constitutes about 10 million olive trees, which means that about 100,000 families rely on olive trees and on the olive harvest season as a main source of income. And we see that every year, especially in the last 3 years, there's an escalation of settler violence trying to prevent farmers from accessing their land. But thanks to Faza, tens of families have been able to break this barrier of fear that is being instilled through systematic settler violence and reach their land. Another thing is that Faza represents an attempt by Palestinians to emphasize Palestinian legitimacy and their right to their land, because basically Faza challenges Israel's permit system, where the Israeli authorities claim that if Palestinian farmers don't want to be encountered by settlers, they need to apply for the Israeli civil administration to get a permit and coordinate with the Israeli army. And they rarely gain any of these permits. But it's an Israeli attempt to delegitimize Palestinian right to their land and emphasize that they are the ones in control or who have sovereignty over the land. So when the activists and the farmers go to the land without caring about getting or having that kind of coordination with the Israeli army, which is complicit with the settler groups, or getting a permit, we emphasize that we are the owners of the land and we don't need a permit from our colonizers to access the land. One last point is that Faza is linked to Palestinian culture, because Because the olive harvest season represents an important aspect of our culture. It's also linked to other cultural rituals, to the whole food and dance system in Palestine. And Palestinian culture, like any culture of colonized people, is under the threat of being obliterated by Israel. So continuing to practice it and to practice the olive harvest season, and also to revive the idea of Pesach, which is a cultural value that existed long before the creation of Israel, continuing to keep it alive is important to fight back against Israeli attempts to obliterate Palestinian culture. Thank you.
Could I just add to what Manal was saying there? Because one of the it's a very important thing for international people to be alongside the Palestinians whilst they're harvesting olives. Not everybody internationally can do that, but there are ways in which people can support the farmers' steadfastness and samud and staying on their land. Stop the JNF has a project called Plant a Tree in Palestine. Just as the JNF raises money to plant trees for the expulsion of Palestinians, Stop the JNF raises money in order to assist Palestinians to plant trees and prevent them being expelled and to support their Sumud. So we know that settlers destroy trees, they attack the Palestinians, they burn olives, they burn the vineyards and so on. And so every time they do that, Palestinians obtain new seedlings, saplings for replanting the land and retaking it and refusing to leave. And in a small way, international community can raise money to support that, that goes directly to the grassroots as a form of resistance to the colonization. Stop the JNF website has all the information. So that's a connected project that people listening to this podcast might be able to support.
Thank you both so much, and for inspiring us and our listeners around resistance and providing this really important context on the sort of wider history of Israel's settler colonial tactics and the steadfastness of the Palestinian people, even in the most horrendous situations like what we're currently seeing. So we're really aware of how urgent this conversation is and how important it is that we keep talking about Palestine and sharing ways together across civil society, academic spaces, activist spaces to come together and act for Palestine. We're really, really grateful to you both for joining us at UN House Scotland, and sharing these ideas and context and more about your work with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your questions. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
This poem is called The Palestine I Know. It's about the Palestine I grew up with. The Palestine that taught me everything I know about Palestine, and it mainly came through women, and I think it's women who usually hold the story of their nation. The Palestine I know does not have a VIP pass. The Palestine I know does not have a VIP pass, wear Armani suits and French cologne. The Palestine I know does not have a VIP pass, wear Armani suits and French cologne. She smells of sage and za'atar. She is warm like Deir Yassin. The Palestine I know taught me dabke in a shelter in Beirut to the sound of bombs. She gathered the children and laughed. They're just making music for us. All these flames are just making music for us. She was a woman so big with love. She laughed out loud and stomped out loud and laughed out loud and stomped out loud. It's me making the building shake. It's just me making the building shake. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid, children. Don't let them scare you. Don't let them scare you. Don't let them scare you. Don't let them scare you.